This is KJZZ, your member-supported news and information station. I'm Catherine Fortkey, and these are the stories you don't want to miss. For the week of April 10th, here are some top stories. This week, our Transborder Unit reporters are exploring the hidden stories beyond our borders. It's a series of stories from the Dominican Republic and the connections to Arizona. Here's just one of the stories from the series. The World Bank estimates the Dominican Republic will be one of the countries most affected by climate change in the next three decades. Rising sea levels could wash away the country's tropical beaches and the homes of its most vulnerable. As Mariana Dale reports from Santo Domingo, moving an entire community out of harm's way is a complicated endeavor.
In the La Barquita neighborhood, concrete and tin homes huddled together on the banks of the Ozama River. Today, the water's smooth and calm, but it's not always that way. Maria Isabel Reyes has lived here for 23 years with her family and has seen the water surge over the banks and into homes, including hers, many times. She says when the cyclones and storms came, you were always nervous because at any time you could have to leave your home. When the floods receded, people returned and began again. But today, Reyes will leave La Barquita for the last time. She watches workers pack all the contents of her dingy lime green home into a van. She says she feels a bit nervous. It feels like all the time she's packed up before the storms, but now it's like a prayer has been answered. She'd ask God to open the door to a new place. Because here there wasn't safety in any form. Reyes' family is one of more than 1,600 the Dominican government is moving to brand new apartments far from the reach of the river's floodwaters. As the families leave, the neighborhood is dismantled. The project, called La Nueva Barquita, fulfills a promise President Danilo Medina made to help the people of the impoverished neighborhood in 2012. The $84 million project includes a church, water treatment plants, a child care center, and spaces for business. Cifrido Peña says this is a pilot project and one that will create a precedent both in this country and internationally. He's helping families complete their applications on the day of their big move. And he says truth is, the thing that's a concern for La Nueva Barquita is not just living in a new place. It's a change in these families' whole way of thinking. Residents had to complete workshops meant to help them adjust to their new life. Eredania Rosario Marcelo was president of the neighborhood board in La Vieja Barquita. She says in this new neighborhood, people need to keep their music down and throw away their trash. Here, we have to maintain and keep it up, she says. There has been criticism of the new project. Local media published reports from builders who say they weren't paid on time and people who were excluded from the project. Roberto Barrio studies displacement and resettlement after disasters. He says via Skype, people being moved need to be considered partners in the rebuilding process.
If we don't listen to them, we can perpetuate the effects of disasters.
For example, if people can't find work near their new homes, it's a negative in the long run. Reyes expresses these worries as she leaves the old neighborhood. She wonders whether they're going to give her a job. Otherwise, she doesn't know what she'll do to pay for where she lives.
No, mama, no.
Reyes gets out of the van in front of the multi-story apartments of La Nueva Barquita. They're lined up like pastel Legos. Her new home is on the second floor of a purple building. The streets are clean here, and kids fly kites, or as they call them, chichiguas, overhead. She says everything is beautiful. There's a lot to do to make an empty apartment a home, to build trust with new neighbors, and find a place in a community that's familiar yet also foreign. She's happy, but she's also hungry. So Reyes will get the stove hooked up first. It's time for a meal in her new home. For the Transborder Unit, Mariana Dale, KJZZ News, Santo Domingo.
You can listen to the other stories in the series at transborder.kjzz.org. And from the Fronteras desk, Attorney General Jeff Sessions announced a widening of prosecutions of border-related crime during his stop in Nogales Tuesday morning. From KJZZ's Fronteras desk, Michelle Marisco reports.
He described the U.S.-Mexico border as ground zero, pitting ranchers and other U.S. citizens against cartels and violent gangs, and said immigration enforcement policies of past administrations have come to an end.
For those that continue to seek improper and illegal entry into this country, be forewarned. This is a new era. This is the Trump era.
Since he was confirmed, Sessions has widened the Justice Department's role in immigration prosecutions. His visit to the Nogales shipping port was the first time he unfolded details of what that means. Sessions announced that the department is expanding the prosecution parameters and focusing on those who cross the border illegally more than once.
We will secure this border and bring the full weight of both the immigration courts and the federal enforcement and prosecutors to combat this attack on our national security and our sovereignty.
His announcement contrasted with recent federal data that shows immigration prosecutions are already at the top of federal crime within the U.S. Michelle Marisco, KJZZ News, Nogales.
You're listening to the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. And now, from KJZZ's original production, The Show, let's hear about some new research into dogs and stress and how that can influence the chance to leave the shelter.
Shelters in our community do good work rescuing and adopting out dogs, but they can be extremely stressful environments for the animals. All of that barking, being stuck in a small area most of the time, it's not easy. So when someone comes to see if they might want to adopt them, it can be difficult to get a good read of whether that dog is a good match.
Now a doctoral candidate in ASU's Canine Science Collaboratory, is working to find a better way for these canine companions. I'm just so excited that Lauren Gilger got to hang out with dogs, and she's here with more on this, Lauren.
I was too. So Lisa Gunter is studying behavioral neuroscience in dogs at ASU, and her work started as a pilot study at Best Friends Animal Sanctuary in Kanab, Utah. It's like a vacation destination for pet lovers who want to volunteer with the dogs there. And she wanted to know what kind of effect these shelter settings were having on the dogs. So she and her research partner, Erica Feuerbacher, looked at cortisol levels, which measures stress, while the dogs were away from the shelter setting for just one night. And I think both of you know I'm a dog lover, so I went out to the Arizona Humane Society to talk to Gunter about her research, and we had a great time hanging out with an old Rhodesian Ridgeback mix named Rufus while we talked about it.
So I think the shelter environment can be challenging for some dogs. Potentially for some dogs, they may have never been kenneled before. They may have never been around this many dogs before in their lives. And for plenty of dogs that have lived with people, being separated from that attachment figure can be pretty challenging. We also have, just in the kennel space itself, it's pretty small. And dogs can't really do the things that dogs normally do, right? They can't run around in the kennel. They can't go lounge on a sofa. So I think we see a lot of things with space constriction that can all be pretty challenging to being well-behaved.
So when a family comes or someone wants to look at a dog in a shelter and think about adopting them, do they always kind of get the real dog?
That's something that we're so interested in sheltering, because we have these dogs that are coming through our doors, and it's a really stressful situation. We do our best to provide enrichment, interaction time, toys, food games, all these things to help alleviate the stress. But we don't know how that stress is going to impact that individual dog. And so for some dogs, you know, we may see an amping up of behavior, and they do things, you know, whether it's barking or bouncing off the kennel, that they may never do in real life. And then similarly, maybe they're so overwhelmed by this environment that they're just shut down, and we don't get to learn who they really are because they're so worried. And so I think that is one of the things I think our lab and canine research is interested in shelters, is how do we learn about this dog in this really stressful situation so that people can have a better match. And because it's a big commitment, if you're adopting a puppy or even a dog, you know, that's 1 or 2 years old, that could be a 10-year commitment. And so we want to make sure that they have as much information as possible to make a good decision.
Right. So in this study, you looked at a specific program in which you have dogs that do an overnight with a family before they are adopted.
Correct.
And so what did you look at?
Sure. So Best Friends Animal Sanctuary in Kanab, they have a really excellent volunteer program there where at the end of the day, volunteers can take a dog out on an overnight. And so that's kind of was the impetus of our study, is that we looked around at their programs and we just wanted to learn, do they work and how do they work? So we looked at the dog's cortisol levels.
Okay, so you measured that, and what did you find? One night away, what did you find?
Yeah, so just one night away significantly reduced the dog's cortisol levels. And in our mind, that was amazing, that we would have these dogs that were barely, you know, they're out of the shelter for, say, 18 hours, and we're seeing this significant reduction. But the thing that kind of left us, you know, wondering is the next day, it rebounded, and it was back to the same amount it had been before they left. And so while we were excited about that reduction, we thought, you know, well, what's going on? We had just one day of baseline, one day after. What happens if the overnight is two nights instead of one? What happens if we capture a two-day baseline and a two-day post? Like, what's the bigger picture here?
So when you looked at this one shelter in Utah,
yeah,
when the dogs would go for an overnight, what would they do? Would their behavior significantly change with those cortisol levels?
So that's really interesting. And the fosters would report anecdotally that they were like, the dogs would come, you know, into the room, they would relax, and they'd be a little anxious at first, and then they would settle in and snooze. And they would just get a good night's sleep. And that really was something that we were thinking about, because when dogs are in the shelter, I think it's probably really hard to get a good night's sleep. And we know, you know, at least with humans, the impact of sleep can have on our health and our well-being and our mood. So I think that we can't, you know, discount that just a nice, quiet place to rest your head and snuggle up and maybe get to spend some time with people can, maybe that's, you know, a lot of what these dogs need to be able to relax and maybe start learning more about them.
Right. So you'll watch a dog like Rufus here, who we're hanging out with, and like he's walking around sniffing.
Yeah.
He's coming up to us and getting pets. Like, what do you see in him?
Yeah. So I think he's like a really interesting guy, because I think he's been hanging out with us. He definitely enjoys hanging out with us. But you can see here as he's leaning in, he like loves being petted. There's a good man. What is that? What is that? Are you a good boy? Are you so good? Yeah. But at the end of the day, they just love hanging out with us, and they love being petted, cuddling up on the couch. And so I think that sort of companionship, and real companionship, so like we're going for a walk with them and not being on our cell phone, right? And just really spending the time we do have with them and making it quality, I think that goes a long way in having a good, solid relationship with your dog.
And so just from the initial study that you've looked at, what do you think this could be used for? What do you hope this could be helpful in?
Yeah, so I think that the temporary sleepovers, you know, just one or two nights away, I think could potentially be really helpful for dogs just to have a break. It's tough when you're looking for a home and you might be at the shelter for 30 days, 60 days, 90 days. It's a long time to be in a kenneled environment. And so I think that, you know, just one night out could be helpful in just kind of giving them a little bit of a break. You know, maybe this is a really great way for more of the community to help out in helping these dogs find their forever homes, that it might not just be adopting them, but helping them sustain themselves until they can find that good match.
Lisa Gunter is a doctoral candidate in the Canine Science Collaboratory in ASU's Department of Psychology. She and Feuerbacher were recently awarded a grant to continue this study at four more shelters across the country, including here at the Arizona Humane Society. And if you want to see Rufus, he is still up for adoption. We put a link to his page on our website. It's at theshow.kjzz.org. He was sweet.
Laura, thanks.
Thank you.
In science news, it's no secret that the tech sector in the U.S. lacks diversity. Industry leaders have been working for years to make sure their staff is more reflective of the general population. So far, they've come up short. But one high school on the Navajo Nation is hoping to at least make a dent in those statistics. From KJZZ's education desk, Carrie Young takes a closer look.
And if you ride bus 968, you are riding bus...
Every Thursday, just after school, about 10 kids at Shiprock High School get together in Abigail Cooksey's classroom.
Okay, so today I was thinking, y'all, we should work on how to make our robots move.
This is Coding Club.
Everyone's so comfortable with each other here. Like, we just laugh and we program things.
And that's Amber Henderson. She's a junior, and Coding Club is her brainchild, born after completing and loving an 8-week boot camp she attended last summer here at Shiprock High. For Henderson, finding this boot camp was a bit serendipitous. After reading an article about coding in a 17 magazine, she said she knew she wanted to jump in. The trouble was, the only summer boot camps she could find were in big, faraway cities like San Francisco and New York.
I was pretty bummed about that.
The travel from northwestern New Mexico and lodging costs were not something she or her family could swing. But then,
maybe like a month later,
Henderson saw a flyer.
And it was a coding program boot camp for here in Shiprock.
She felt like it was meant to be.
My mom was like, that's a sign, so.
Coincidence or not, Henderson jumped at the chance and joined 8 other Navajo students for the summer class, brought to the school by a tech startup known as Cultivating Coders, through a partnership with Teach for America, and a nonprofit known as Gear Up. But not only did Henderson join other Navajo students, she was taught by Navajo instructors.
I think that's powerful when you see people that look like you doing things that you never thought you could do.
Cultivating Coders founder Charles Ashley says this setup follows the company's larger mission, improving the racial, gender, and geographic diversity of the tech industry.
Our motto is, let's just bring the tools. We'll bring the toolbox, but what we build will come from the community.
Ashley says his program sets up in areas where the need is high, which has tended to be rural communities, in hopes of inspiring someone who might not otherwise get the opportunity to learn what's becoming a lucrative skill.
The goal is, if you can teach just enough, then they can go around and do peer-to-peer training, they can continue to code.
Shiprock High School computer science teacher Abigail Cooksey says while it's only been about a year since last summer's boot camp, it's transformed the way many of her students think about computer science. She explains before, it was more like,
it's a different language, so it looks really overwhelming, it looks really complicated. It's definitely creates a mindset of, oh, that looks too hard, I can't do that.
But not anymore. Today, Coding Club is about 10 students strong, most of which Cooksey says now tell her they want to pursue a career in computer science.
Which is really, really cool, considering that our club is entirely Native and probably 90% female.
So can efforts like these to improve diversity in the pathway to computer science careers really make a difference in the overall tech industry diversity? Dr. Kim Scott, the director of Arizona State University's Center for Gender Equality in Science and Technology, says yes and no.
I think that if we have more African-American, Native American, Latina, and Asian American women in particular in tech industries, yes, that has solved the issue of diversity. However, diversity is different than inclusion.
According to a 2016 report by Intel and Dalberg Global Development Advisors, about 2/3 of tech employees were white at that point in time. While a lack of diversity is something industry leaders have acknowledged is an issue, Scott says in order to attract and, more importantly, retain a diverse workforce, there's more to the equation than just learning how to code.
It has to be how to collaborate, how to think in a computational manner, how to write a persuasive argument, and how to lead.
But Scott adds, if and when the industry does reach a diversity level that reflects the population, it could be a game changer in terms of innovation and productivity. Reporting from the Shiprock chapter of the Navajo Nation, I'm Carrie Young.
And finally this week, in a look at business news, a pair of Phoenix-based trucking companies are joining forces. From KJZZ's West Valley Bureau, Matthew Casey reports the board of directors for Knight and Swift Transportation have approved a multi-billion-dollar merger.
The deal is worth an estimated $6 billion. Knight and Swift already have huge truck fleets operating internationally. Officials say the merger will transform them into an industry giant. The new venture, dubbed Knight Swift Transportation Holdings Incorporated, will have common ownership. But the Knight and Swift brands will continue to operate separately. Both companies' stockholders must approve the deal. Officials expect it to be finalized sometime between July and the end of September. The new company will have about 28,000 employees, and its headquarters will remain in Phoenix. Matthew Casey, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Thank you.
This has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by Vitalist Health Foundation, the IEEE Foundation, the Arizona Community Foundation, the ASU Biodesign Institute, Alliance Bank of Arizona, Beach Fleischman, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to KJZZ and for your generous support. I'm Catherine Fritke, and this is KJZZ, your news and information source.